Good evening. I feel especially honored to stand at this podium because I know something of what lurks in the archives here. I've done a little bit of work on John Adams for previous projects, a little bit of work on John Quincy Adams, as well as Thomas Jefferson. And some of you may know the delightful story of the Jefferson descendant, the matriarch of the Jefferson branch of the Coolidge tree, in fact, who, at the behest of her grandfather, sought out his old colleague, John Adams. Let's see if this, I can make this work. Ellen Wales Randolph Coolidge, known as Ellen, was new to Boston. This is actually her mother. She was Thomas Jefferson's daughter. Ellen was newly married to one Joseph Coolidge, Jr., and they'd taken their vows in 1825 in the parlor at Monticello. The previous year, Coolidge had arrived with a recommendation from a Harvard scholar by the name of Joseph Ticknor, who had said of him, "He is a gentleman of education and fortune and an amiable and excellent character." Jefferson definitely felt that way, and I guess Ellen must have too, seeing as how they did get married. And this is Ellen, an image you probably know. She was older as brides of the day go. She was 29 when they married. But maybe two of the reasons that she didn't get married as early as she might have done were Monticello, which was her home. She lived there most of her young adulthood and childhood, as her mother had functioned as her grandfather's hostess. And, of course, the other reason was Thomas Jefferson. She was his favorite granddaughter. He said of her rather charmingly once, "If she had been a man, she would have been a great one." Which we may see as condescending today, but I'm sure he intended it as a very great compliment. They played chess under the trees at Monticello in the summertime, and after she departed, in fact, her sister Virginia wrote to her while she was on her wedding trip and said that her grandfather, Thomas Jefferson, occasionally, when seated in the parlor, would gaze at Ellen's accustomed chair with a look of longing in his eye, at which point someone else would immediately sit in the chair. But I don't think anyone could replace Ellen in his eyes. But now that she was in Boston, she had an errand to complete, and she went to Quincy, and she had been entrusted with a letter to deliver to John Adams. This is an image of my friend, Mr. Jefferson, who sent this letter. Jefferson's old friend from their days in the Continental Congress, and also they'd served together in Europe during the 1780s when Jefferson was minister to France and Adams was minister to the court of St. James. When she got there, she found an 88-year-old widower residing on the second floor of his house in Quincy, living as Jefferson was amid two generations of his family, living out his days lame, nearly blind, but as Ellen reported to her grandfather, "As far as his mind is concerned, he seems to have preserved fully the full vigor of his intellect, all the sprightliness of his fancy, all the vivacity of his thoughts and opinions." I find this moment interesting and moving in a way that the much more famous moment that occurred on July 4th, 1826, was really when they both died on the same day. That was really more coincidence, but when we have Jefferson's messenger in the same room with John Adams, there's a sense of continuity, of connectedness, which I like and which makes me especially happy to be here. I'm here to talk not about this man, but about the sage of Monticello. I think, by the way, it was Abigail who coined that. I was, in my research for this talk tonight, I was trying to come up with the exact reference, but I wasn't able to find it. If anyone of you know where it is, tell me afterwards, would you? But I think she was the one who called him the sage of Monticello. This is by no means the first time I've talked about Jefferson. I've been doing this for, despite the fact I'm a good Yankee, I've been doing this for a while, despite the several centuries of yeoman Yankee blood in my veins. Worcester County. Thank you very much. I've been drawn to write about Jefferson on and off for some 20 years. Here's partial proof of how long it's been. This is my daughter Elizabeth, who is now 5'11" and a sophomore at New Orleans. She went even further south than I did. But while I was doing research in 1995, when I took this picture, that was when I first came across the other man I'm going to talk about tonight, who, of course, as Dennis warned you, is Fisk Kimball. By way of an aside, I'd like to observe that it's a special pleasure to return to the subject of Fisk Kimball because, as a writer of books, you dispatch them into the world like children, only to see them all too often sink like stones into the deep blue sea. So it's really quite wonderful when a message in a bottle arrives, as one did from Dennis several months ago, saying, come and talk about Kimball and Jefferson at the Massachusetts Historical Society. In that charge, in that email charge, as Dennis put it to me, your work on Jefferson, Fisk Kimball, and the founding of the study of American architectural history is to be your subject. So hereafter, I will talk about that, though, as you've already observed, no doubt, I do have a tendency from time to time to get lost and tell other stories. But the principal one tonight is the tale of a paper chase. And my chief pursuer will be this man. Now, every writer, whether he or she writes fiction or nonfiction, is always looking for a good plot. And when I came across Jefferson and Kimball and their connection, I knew I had met up with a true and important detective story about a piece of American history that had been forgotten. But to tell it, we must jump ahead a century from Ellen Coolidge in the early 19th century. It's the winter of 1912. This man is 23. He's in Cambridge. He's working on an MArch degree at Harvard. He's recently returned from a loafing fellowship, so-called, in which he traveled around Europe looking at the great architectural sites. He's seen the sun rise over Chartres. He's walked the Amalfi Coast. He's been to Berlin and London. He's fallen in love with Paris. But here he is, back in Cambridge, in a snowy January, with coal dust covering the snow, wondering why the hell he isn't back in Paris. He's saved by the appearance at his desk of another man from his department, a man named George Henry Chase, who appears at his desk and says, Kimball, I have a project for you. Chase had just signed a contract with Harper Brothers to do a series of monographs about the arts. Chase himself was going to write the book on painting. Another colleague was going to write the book on sculpture. And they had hoped that a senior member of the department would do the book on architecture, but he was otherwise occupied doing a similar book for Macmillan, so they turned to Kimball. He was all over it. In a moment, he accepted the assignment. He said later, it was a wonderful chance, and I started plowing through the antique stuff. Now, we jump ahead 18 months. It's the summer of 1913. He's back in Boston. He spent a year at Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois teaching. And the good news is he came back with a wife. The bad news is he came back without a job. Now, whether that was because of a nepotism rule or because he could be brash and at times a little on the vulgar side isn't altogether clear. But in any case, he was looking for a job, but he was still working on the architecture book. Every morning he went to the Harvard Library, and one day after he went off to his researches, Marie was going through his clothes and found in one of his pockets a shard of paper. Didn't have a phone number on it. It wasn't a girlfriend or anything like that. But it had four words. It said, Jefferson as an architect. At which point, she said to herself, Jefferson? What's this mean? Who's Jefferson? 100 years ago, no one knew that Thomas Jefferson was an architect. I went back and looked at the Encyclopedia Britannica that was the current edition at that time. I think it was 1911. There was an 8,000-word essay about Thomas Jefferson. And the only mention of architecture of any sort in the Encyclopedia Britannica was at the end of his term in 1809, he returned to his home in Charlottesville, Monticello. He had no idea that he'd ever been interested in or cared about a building in his life. In fact, he died in 1826. As early as 1834, the first serious work of art history was published, called History of the Rise and Progress of the Arts of Design in the United States, written by a sometime playwright, sometime historian by the name of William Dunlop, also a painter. And he attributed the design of Monticello to Robert Mills. Kimball, in fact, was inspired to write that little piece of paper and shove it in his pocket because he'd come across a more recent essay by a man named Glenn Brown, who was an early architectural historian, who had attributed the University of Virginia, because of this drawing, to William Thornton. And he'd just written down, Kimball had written down that Jefferson as an architect out of some sort of scholarly instinct. And he had great instincts, as the story that emerges here will demonstrate. He came home, Marie bearded him and said, "What's this about?" He explained what I've just explained to you. And she said, "May I have it?" She was highly educated, college graduate, very smart. Father was a college professor. He was busy, so he said, "Sure, fine, go for it, have fun." Now, she did some work, and she found some interesting things. She learned a little bit about Monticello. She learned a little bit about the Virginia Capitol. She learned a little bit about his collaborators in various places. She learned a little bit about Poplar Forest, which was another house that Jefferson designed that sadly had burned to a masonry hulk in 1845. Kimball began to take part in the research also, and together they found some more stuff, but not enough to really make the case that Jefferson was what they both, by this point, assumed that he was, a serious contributor to early American architecture. So they wrote, at Marie's suggestion, Kimball wrote two letters. One went to the Library of Congress. Basically, they were looking for the drawings. Kimball was always looking for the drawings. And they got no encouragement from the Library of Congress. The other letter was written to, surprise, surprise, the Massachusetts Historical Society, where they did get encouragement. A man by the name of Worthington Ford held what is, I guess, essentially Dennis's job today, although he was referred to as editor. He was the principal person here at the Historical Society. And he was, in his own right, an important scholar. He'd already edited George Washington's papers. He'd worked on Monroe. He would do a lot of work on the Adams family in the coming couple of decades. And he wrote back to Kimball and said, "Well, no, actually, we don't have any drawings in the collection. There were some 10,000 Jefferson pieces of paper, but no drawings." But he wrote back and said, "There is a descendant who I'm told does have some drawings. And perhaps I could arrange to have those drawings put on deposit temporarily here so that you could have a look at them." Now, I think there's a bottle of water here. Oh, there it is. Now, from childhood, remember that game, Statues, where we all sort of freeze? We're going to freeze right now at the beginning of the 20th century, and we're going to go back in time, and we're going to meet up again with Ellen Coolidge. Now, she, after having married Joseph Coolidge, Jr. in 1825, bore a number of children, and her first son was named after her beloved grandfather. He became Thomas Jefferson Coolidge. And he would be the first in a line of like-named Bostonians. His son, Thomas Jefferson Coolidge, Jr., went south to visit his Virginia cousins after the Civil War, and many years later wrote a memoir about his experience there, in which he talked about the time he spent with his great-uncle Jeff Randolph, who was Ellen's brother, and also a grandchild of Thomas Jefferson. "A fine, hearty, old Virginia gentleman, despite his age," wrote Coolidge. His memories at that time, he added, stayed with the boy from Massachusetts, bringing the household at Monticello quite close to the present. Now, his childhood trips to Albemarle County helped inspire in him a lifelong interest in his great-grandfather. He was reminded of Monticello by the ink and wash rendering that Robert Mills had done for Mr. Jefferson in about 1803 that had hung in Monticello's dining room. When the house was broken up after his death, this drawing came to Boston, and it hung in Grandmother Ellen's house. In turn, it had been presented to his father, and in turn, Thomas Jefferson Coolidge Jr. had it. So he went to Virginia in pursuit of knowledge, I guess, in the 19-teens, actually 1911, and inquired of his cousins whether there were any drawings, found that indeed there were, and whatever plans, and he bought them, acquired them. I don't know if he was gifted them or not. It isn't clear from the paperwork. But he brought them back in Boston, brought to Boston. Now, whatever plans he had for them were left unfulfilled because he died the following year in 1912. Which brings us back to Fisk Kimball. I'm going to read you a little piece from the book about what happened next. Money was tight for the Kimballs, so they decided Fisk would come alone to Massachusetts, even though Marie was very much a partner in the project. As he explained in a letter to his parents, in this way, we will limit the resulting expense to about $50, which we think is amply justified by the scientific results to be obtained. Kimball already saw himself as a pioneer in a fundamental shift in architectural history, away from hearsay to close physical examination. And Jefferson just might be his test case. Marie went to Champaign-Urbana to visit her parents at Easter, and Kimball took the train east. On the morning of April 6, 1914, he traveled from his parents' home in Dorchester to Boylston Street in Boston's Fenway neighborhood. He arrived promptly at 10 o'clock. He hadn't known what to expect, but the material laid before him at the Massachusetts Historical Society looked as if it had been forgotten in an attic for a very long time. The antique renderings Kimball examined were foxed, and their edges bore chew marks where mice had munched the margins. Having seen a few of Jefferson's drawings, he immediately recognized Jefferson's hand as he organized the drawings into piles and categories. Kimball's mind was soon racing. He'd been confident on his arrival that morning that he knew more of Jefferson's design than anyone. But here he confronted much that he didn't know, many buildings that he didn't recognize. Kimball found himself sneezing as the attic dust swirled around him. The Coolidge collection was a treasure trove. It was marvelous, he reported. There were 300 or 400 drawings, many highly competent. Some were scrap that were in outline only. They constituted a wilderness of the most obscure kind, said Kimball. There was scarcely a signature on the lot, rarely any title, and but few dates, though many of the drawings were covered with notes and calculations in Jefferson's handwriting. In his mind, Kimball had envisioned a neat and self-contained Jeffersonian landscape. But that morning, he found himself surrounded by an undiscovered landmass where he glimpsed many new and important vistas of Jefferson territory. You can sense the scholar's excitement, I hope, in this find of a lifetime. One of the drawings he found was this one, and I put it up here in part because it's an absolutely charming building in Annapolis called the Hammond Harwood House, which some of you may know. It's a museum open to the public. But also because up in the corner there, there's a K, which doesn't stand for Kerschel. We're not talking Mozart here, but it does stand for Kimball. And it, along with the N, which is for Nichols, who was a subsequent Jefferson scholar, they're lovely little time signatures, I think, for students of the Jeffersonian past. In any case, it played out this way. The widow Coolidge, that is, Clara Amory Coolidge, agreed to underwrite a book. Kimball was given $1,000 to be its editor. One of the first things he did was journey to Virginia, for the first time, by the way, where he visited the university, the Virginia capital, and Monticello. His examination of the drawings had led him to make hundreds of guesses and make some conclusions and devise some insights about Jefferson, about Monticello, about his various works. And he was very fortunate to be taken through the bowels of the building where he had many things confirmed. And I'll talk a bit about more about that in a moment. He set to work trying to organize the drawings, trying to collate the drawings with what he saw in person. Meanwhile, Marie went through all the correspondence, some 25,000 Jefferson papers at the Library of Congress, the 20-odd thousand papers here at the Historical Society, looking for any reference of any sort to architecture. The result was the book, Thomas Jefferson, Architect Filled with Facsimile Reproductions. The original edition, of which we have a copy over here, is an elephant folio, although most people know it from the 1968 reprint, of which we also have a copy, which I think we're encouraged to touch rather than the fancier one, the earlier one. The first edition was only 350 copies, and this is the presentation letter that went out with the copies. For my money, it's not only a masterpiece of bookmaking from the old Riverside Press, it's really quite a wonderful book, but it's also an excellent piece of scholarship. Today, most everything that students of Jefferson as architect take as received wisdom come directly from the pen and the perceptive brain of Fisk Kimball, most of which is to be found in this book. In the years that followed, Kimball would play a leading role in establishing for the first time that architectural history merited close examination. And if he and Marie had not pursued every lead, the Jefferson drawings might have been relegated for another century to an attic after having spent one in Virginia. Maybe it would have spent another one in Massachusetts. Who knows? But today, because Kimball did find those drawings, school children learn that Jefferson was the first great native-born architect. Because of Kimball's scholarship, as he asserted, Jefferson is truly to be called the father of our national architecture. For his part, Kimball would soon be known as the Dean of Architectural History in America, thanks in no small part to Thomas Jefferson Architect. But perhaps the most remarkable of all is that this book was the first critical biography ever written of an American architect. No one, it seemed, had cared very much before. Now, even though it started with Jefferson, in no sense did Kimball's endeavors end there. The year the big book went to press, Kimball was awarded a Sachs Fellowship, Sachs as in Goldman Sachs, as in David Sachs, one of the founding partners of Goldman Sachs, who gave some money to Harvard, which enabled Kimball to take a sabbatical from his job. He by then moved on to the University of Michigan. And the list of the stops in his itinerary is too long to cite, but it included Washington, Annapolis, and Philadelphia, and Trenton, and Nashville, and the Savannah, and Charleston, and Chapel Hill, and so on. Of course, he also came to Boston, where he studied, among other things, this man's work. While we're looking at Bulfinch, two peripheral facts I think are a little bit interesting here. One is that the first home of the Massachusetts Historical Society was the room over the Great Arch in Bulfinch's Franklin Crescent, which was the real estate development that actually ruined him financially. But he provided that room to the Massachusetts Historical Society for its early collections. The second little factoid is that this man's sister, Elizabeth, married a man named Joseph Coolidge, who subsequently had a child named Joseph Coolidge Jr., who, of course, married a sweet young girl from Virginia named Ellen. A very small world it was. Anyway, Kimball worked on Thornton, William Thornton, the man who won the competition for the United States Capitol in the 1790s, which, of course, Jefferson engineered. He had fingers in lots of architectural pies at this point. He worked on James Hoban, who won a similar competition to design what was then known as the President's House, although we, of course, call it the White House today. He worked on John McComb, who designed the City Hall in New York City. He did early work on this man, Robert Mills. He did work on a man named Harrison, Peter Harrison. Think King's Chapel, that magnificent building here in Boston. He did work on lots of folks. His bibliography from those years actually tells the story very well. In the decade that he devoted himself to writing about American architecture, he published some 75 articles and reviews, 3 books, all the while teaching and establishing not only the architecture school at the University of Virginia, which didn't have an architecture school until they hired Campbell to start one in 1919, and subsequently starting the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU in 1921, which, of course, is the wonderfully prestigious graduate school of fine arts that exists today. It kind of leaves me breathless to describe what he does, and at the risk of hyperbole, one might say his typewriter was on fire in those days. The richness of those years and Kimball's scholarly method are probably best summed up in another book, which is to say, Domestic Architecture of the American Colonies and Early Republic. Thanks to its scope and availability, it's still in print. Its influence has undoubtedly been as great as that of Thomas Jefferson Architect. It came about because of an invitation from one Henry Kent at the Metropolitan Museum of New York, who wrote him asking if he would consider giving, and this, I love this, a series of important lectures. Of course, Kimball, not the least bit daunted, was there in a minute. Well, actually, 6 months later, he was standing at the podium delivering lectures, and 2 years afterwards, this book appeared, published by Scribner's. Now, to look closely at this book, that is to say, to read it, to examine it, is to understand something about Kimball's approach to architectural history, which distinguished him from his predecessors. It was described by one reviewer as a model of precision and fact, and I think that this table, which I'm going to show you in a moment, suggests something of his method. Lewis Mumford, who was a thinker with whom Kimball rarely agreed, described it as the first book that has even attempted to cover in a systematic fashion the whole field of early American architecture. Now, what he did was he incorporated all the buildings. Did I miss one here? Yes, here we go. He only put buildings in this book for which he knew the dates of construction. So strict chronology was his guide, which gave it the something of the quality of precision. We have our doubts about that today, but at the time it was a revelation that he would approach it so seriously as opposed to thinking of it in a much more nostalgic kind of vein. There was more to his process, of course. Diligent sourcing, careful drawings, physical examination of the artifacts. There's a set of note cards at the Philadelphia Museum where his papers are, where he's made hundreds and hundreds of drawings of bricks, of overmantels, of all kinds of architectural details. There's more to tell of Kimball's later life, which I think I should move on to. In 1927, he enunciated what he termed as the best principles of restoration on behalf of John D. Rockefeller and the Reverend Goodwin at Colonial Williamsburg, which was just being established. He was the brains behind the key sort of consultant in deciding how to restore things there, which was clearly the most influential experiment in the American past at that time. Kimball also supervised the restoration activities at Monticello, at Gunston Hall, at Stratford Hall. He was a founder of the Journal of the American Society of Architectural Historians, contributed an article to its first issue. He also wrote a pair of articles, interestingly, for the Journal of the Royal Institute of British Architects, called Burlington Architectus. The pieces made a case that Richard Boyle, the Earl of Burlington, who, again, we all accept today as the architect Earl, but then was thought to have been kind of a dilettante who was, you know, maybe he was a benefactor of a couple of architects named William Kent and Henry Flitcroft, was not in his own right a great architect. Well, Kimball made the case, took quite a lot of criticism for it in the English press at the time, but now it's completely accepted wisdom that Burlington was a wonderful architect. Now, if Kimball had had his way, he also would have written a biography of this man, arguably the greatest architect of his generation, Benjamin Henry de Trobe. But through an accident of timing, it didn't happen. That's a story for another day. But another founding member of the architectural historian, that founding generation of architectural historians, did write a biography of him, a man named Talbot Hamlin. Ironically, Hamlin's book was published in the year Kimball died, 1955. And it's a book I recommend to anyone interested in historic architecture. Now, the sheer volume of Kimball's work doesn't prove anything, of course, nor does its diversity, although I think it's worth mentioning that in that book that he wrote for Chase, he talked about Baroque architecture as distinct from Renaissance architecture, an unheard-of notion at the time, which again, today in the Academy is a completely accepted notion. 25 years after that, he wrote a book called The Creation of the Rococo, and he did what he always did. He looked to the architects, he looked to the drawings, and he separated the Rococo from the Baroque, which, again, at the time was a very novel idea. But I spent a month last summer as an Addingham Fellow in England looking at great late 17th, early 18th century houses that are full of Rococo carving. Kimball's name comes up again and again and again. He's the guy who identified what it was, how it was different, how it was important in his own time. To shift from his writings, which I really need to do because Kimball had, in effect, a second career as a museum director, it's really the career for which he is better known, I think, by the general public. For 30 years, he was director of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, from 1925 to 1955. When he was hired, it was an obscure museum of textiles and industry with a new building that was under construction that was referred to as the Greek Garage. For a good reason, I think. Anyway, Kimball did nothing less than turn it into one of the great treasure houses of North America. Indeed, Kimball had a busy and diverse life. Just to list a few of the things he did, he was a professor, an architect, a scholar, a curator, a university administrator. He was an architectural historian, a restoration architect, a museum director, a college dean. And he was also a political operative in that he was appointed by FDR to mastermind the construction of the Jefferson Monument, which he did with the help of a board of advisors on which sat a man by the name of Thomas Jefferson Coolidge III. So we're back to those Coolidges again. And yet, Kimball was also interesting in a personal way. I thought it was, I was very disappointed in doing this research, in fact, to learn that he was a wonderful teller of dirty jokes and that none of those dirty jokes survive. Otherwise, I would regale you with one. But unfortunately, although people were happy to tell me that he told those jokes, they either didn't remember them or they were too polite to tell me. He was said to be a positive hazard behind the wheel of a car. Marie called him my cowboy driver. He wore Brooks Brothers all the time. There's at the museum, the Philadelphia Museum, where there are 500 linear feet of papers, which is an unfathomable amount, you know, hundreds of filing cabinets full. There's a thick file of correspondence with Brooks Brothers where he's always complaining about this or that. You know, he's a very, very particular man. You probably remember that he had a pince-nez in one of those earlier images. He affected that for several decades. He was a physically large man, 6'1", and his weight sort of rose from 200 on up. When he was first being interviewed for the job as director at the Philadelphia Museum in 1925, he had dinner at the president of the board of directors' house. And as they rose from the dining table, a large crack was heard. And they looked down at the chair he'd been sitting on, which was, by the way, from the workshop of George Heppelwhite. So this is a fine piece of furniture. And there was a great split in the splat. He was a bull in a china shop, but brilliant and driven and a man of great intellectual appetites. During his three decades at the PMA, Kimball was a familiar sight at his English partner's desk, which he's sitting at here. The desk suited him. He thickened with age and inclination. He put on weight. And in fact, his presence was almost at times ballistic as he wielded his tremendous energies, firing off the word bully from time to time. Recall that his teenage years were not under the FDR era, but were TRs. My work on Kimball took me not only to Boston and to Philadelphia, but also to Charlottesville. Well, most of the papers are at the PMA. There are some at the Alderman Library at the University of Virginia, including quite a few of Marie's, who in her own right is to be respected as a scholar and a writer. She left three of a projected five-volume biography of Jefferson. Kimball joked that she loved Jefferson more than she loved him. Kimball also took me to Harvard, where many of Kimball's architectural papers are archived, and to a dozen other sites, among them Gunston Hall, Stratford Hall, Peabody Essex, New York Historical Society, and so on. But I find it very interesting that Kimball couldn't stay away from Charlottesville, despite the fact that he complained at times that the patrician Virginians condescended to him. He was a Yankee, after all, and he always seemed to draw attention to himself as something less than what you would call a reserved man. In fact, there's a story that once at an uproarious party, he dared to roll in a barrel down the slope of the near-sacred ground of the lawn, which just wasn't done, I suppose. But in a sense, I think he had his revenge years later when he built... Oops, I'm behind here. When he built this house, it was to be a summer and retirement home. It's in Charlottesville. When I go there, I always try and visit Shack Mountain, as it is called. It's a jewel box atop Shackelford Mountain, and it remains essentially unchanged from Kimball's day. It's quite a wonderful house, not so large in scale. There are only two principal rooms to the right and left of the entrance here, a dining room and a parlor, but it's possessed of a real grandeur, one might even say a Jeffersonian grandeur, that is ever so much greater than what might expect in a modest house. Now, partly, of course, it was Jefferson and Monticello that kept Kimball coming back to Virginia. Kimball had a long-term relationship with Monticello, which when he first visited it in 1914, remember he was there on Clara Amory Coolidge's nickel. This is more or less what he saw. He arrived at lots of questions he wanted to ask, some of which he found answers to, again, thanks to his visit to the basements of the house. And he already had some images in his mind, one of which was the so-called Monticello I, which I think of as the Villa Carnaro incarnation. It was the original design that was never finished, based on the 16th century Italian architect Andrea Palladio's design for a house in Piombino Daisy outside of Venice. That was the Four Books of Architecture by Palladio was Jefferson's Bible. That was the term he used to describe it. So that was the first plan, but then he went to France. He saw the Hotel de Somme. He saw lots of things that he really liked over there, and he came up with a different design, which is better represented here by the Mills image that we saw earlier, that Mills executed while Jefferson was in the White House, interestingly enough, and Mills was a young draftsman kind of apprenticing with Jefferson. But it was Kimball who first alerted the world to the fact that there were two Monticellos, as scholars call them today, Monticello I and Monticello II. When Monticello entered the public domain in 1923 and became a museum, having previously been in the hands of a family, Fisk was immediately put in charge of the restoration. Shortly thereafter, Marie became its curator. And I like to think of it as a wonderful case of, you know, what goes around comes around. His work on the Jefferson drawings made it possible to rediscover that Jefferson was an architect. His career was launched with the book. And in doing so, he put Jefferson back on the architectural map. I want to close with a story, one that dates from the end of Kimball's life. Will Rogers called sculptor Joe Davidson the last of the savage headhunters, and one head he bagged belonged to Fisk Kimball. Davidson, born 1883, died 1952, American sculptor trained at L'École des Beaux-Arts. He spent about 40 years making portrait busts of all kinds of folks, not so famous and famous, including Gandhi, FDR, Helen Keller, Albert Einstein, more than 200 other subjects. Shortly after World War II, the Philadelphia Museum held a series of public events called Fun with Art, and at one of them, on January 5th, 1949, Kimball agreed to sit for Davidson as the sculptor executed what he called a clay portrait sketch. Kimball was always reluctant to pose for pictures, and his reticence was usually obvious in the end result. As Marie said of him, he's usually the old stiff. But he'd grown accustomed to crowds and his public role in Philadelphia, so like a good soldier, at 8 o'clock, he marched onto the stage together with Davidson. They stood before a crowd of some 200 people. The men had never met, but Kimball and Davidson blended like Fred and Ginger. Kimball was a bundle of nervous energy, mugging for the audience. But Davidson took charge, maneuvering his subject about until he found the vantage he wanted. Their dialogue charmed the crowd, and Davidson got to work. He smacked great gobs of clay onto a metal armature. Davidson, in a sense, was trying to do in an evening what I needed several years to do. He had a bucket of wet clay at hand to transform into a bust of Dr. Kimball. I must say I often thought of him as I worked at my raw materials, which were books and articles and tens of thousands of pages of Kimball's own papers, many of them browned and crumbling with age. But Davidson's goal that day and mine were very much the same. We wanted to make likenesses of the man, recognizable to his friends, but durable too. On that Wednesday evening in 1949, Davidson captured more of the man than anyone could reasonably have expected. With his chin raised and his head tipped to one side, Kimball in clay was imperious, looking askance, the smartest guy in the room, but nervous, yet shy. Looking more closely, I think there's a distant sadness, too. He's a man beyond his prime, aware of a future with fewer prospects and more pain. Then there's that dignity, that mix of pride and humility, humor and intensity that made him such a powerful presence. Kimball helped me understand that trustworthy history isn't about random, unfiltered recollections. It's about collective memory shaped as objectively as possible. Paradoxically, history consists of good stories, like this one, about Kimball, vibrantly alive, spontaneous, on a cold January evening in Philadelphia with Joe Davidson. His big head and fleshy neck, be sure to make plenty of chins, he instructed Davidson, to the delight of the audience. We're left with an image of his sheer physicality. Yet Kimball was most of all a man of the mind. His memory cannot be separated from the lessons he taught about architecture. Buildings are about more than space or even defying gravity. Great American buildings of the sort he examined are cultural capital. But understanding them requires thinking of them in terms of added dimensions of time and memory, the men, the motivations, the historical currents that made them possible. Kimball's voluminous writings remain of value in our attempt to integrate those layers of meaning. From an historiographic standpoint, not a few of more recent stewards at the houses where Kimball worked, like Gunston Hall and Stratford in particular, but also a couple of the houses in Fairmount Park and Philadelphia, have second-guessed some of the judgment calls he made, in particular as a restoration architect. Certainly, he was also at times brash and bombastic. He manifested very little interest in vernacular architecture, which, of course, is of consuming interest to many people today. He also adhered to an art historical vision of the past that was largely aesthetic, The more diverse cultural view we take today, thinking of personal narratives, material culture, those really weren't in play at that point. However, to have your work surpassed by researchers that follow, that is the lot, I think, of pioneer scholars. And by the way, the disappearance of his early pencil strokes behind later layerings of color doesn't alter the fact that Kimball produced the early outlines on which later scholars are still very much at work. Anyway, Davidson's demonstration was a great success, and the clay likeness he produced pleased everyone, including Kimball. Now, it may not be a great work of art, but today we know where it is. It's at the Philadelphia Museum. It's in a conference room just off the director's office, which seems to me kind of right and proper in that it means that Kimball is still there looking over the shoulders of those who have followed him at the museum. And in a larger sense, I think that that's really his legacy, to look over shoulders. Certainly, I felt his hot breath as I was working at the book that I was working on. When I began thinking about writing a book about early American architecture, I knew I had to use Jefferson as the focus. He was central, the single most important force in marching architecture forward in his new country. But by the time I was done, I understood what Kimball's work meant too. His most essential principle, which was out with revivalist nostalgia, if you will, and in with fact-based discipline, is all important. And the advent of Kimball's work and that of others who followed him signaled the genuine sea change that truly established architectural history as an academic discipline. But for Kimball, it was even simpler than that, really, because it always came down to the drawings. He was trained as an architect. He worked as an architect. He himself was a very good draftsman. He dotted his correspondence and his papers with pen and ink sketches. And as my portrait of Jefferson took place, I found that Fisk Kimball kept inserting himself into the frame. Didn't take me very long as I read at the literature of all the key characters in that era, Benjamin Latrobe, William Thornton, Robert Mills, Charles Bulfinch, and especially Jefferson, that without Kimball, their stories probably would have been told quite differently. After all, to visit the past, one needs a map, and Kimball left us an indelible topography. One last word. A few years ago, the owner of Shack Mountain bought some architectural artifacts from the university. These plinths and so forth and capitals had sat in a field somewhere. She'd watched them for years, and then she noticed an advertisement in the Charlottesville paper that they were for sale. As instructed, she submitted a closed bid, subsequently got a phone call saying they were hers. She arranged for them to be moved to the edge of the forest at Shack Mountain. And there they are today, half obscured by years of fallen leaves on the forest floor. Now, perhaps some future architectural historian or archaeologist will be fooled into thinking that a temple once stood near Mr. Kimball's house. And perhaps a wiser person will come along, as Sidney Fisk Kimball did, and explain exactly what it is they have found. Thank you kindly for listening. Question? Sir?
Yes, he seems to have been all over the map geographically. Is he memorialized anywhere besides his statue?
You know, he's buried in Charlottesville. And there are certainly repositories of his papers, as I said, lots and lots of different places. But beyond that, I don't think so. They had no children, he and Marie. They were childless. I take that back. At the University of Virginia, there is the Fisk Kimball Memorial Fine Arts Library, which is a great library. And that's a very fitting place for him. And there is also the principal donor, major donor organization at the Philadelphia Museum is the Fisk Kimball Society. So he has a presence and a place in a surprising number of places, although I don't think there's a statue to him any place.
Any schools of architecture named after him?
No, although, again, at the library at the University of Virginia, he's a real presence.
Any other questions?
I was saying earlier that Peter Drummond would be outraged if he were to hear this, but when he took the drawing, when he decided to do the book on the Thomas Jefferson architect, they gave him the drawings, he put them in a trunk, and he took them out to Michigan, which, I mean, I know they're going on the road now, but I think the standards were probably a little bit different in those days. And he put them in piles. Now, exactly what those piles were, I don't, you know, I'm being facetious, but I guess all I can say is that he looked at things piece by piece and date by date and tried to organize them in that fashion, which is a system that I don't think works terribly well today. But given that there was no other system at that point, aside from, oh, my God, my grandfather said it was a beautiful place and whatever, I think it was a kind of first position of organizing things. And elements, architectural elements and dates, I think, were the sort of two guiding principles to that. So there were over mantles. And if you read, you know, the best answer to this question is get yourself, if you don't have one, acquire a copy of Domestic Architecture and spend 20 minutes with it, and you can see what his kind of basic operating principles were. Roundabout answer, sorry. Yes?
How many major buildings did Thomas Jefferson influence?
Well, you know, we always talk about his four principal works, which were Monticello, his Escape, which is to say Poplar Forest, in Forest, Virginia, outside of Lynchburg, the Virginia Capitol, which he designed in cooperation with. It's not actually exactly clear how much work he did and how much work Charles-Henri Clarisseau did, who was the French designer that he hired to design. But clearly, it was a collaboration to some degree. And then the University of Virginia, which, of course, makes that answer hard because there are 10 pavilions and the rotunda and 6 hotels and the now-destroyed anatomy building. So basically 4 principal works. Plus he designed some, you know, he did some napkin sketching for friends. So the Farmington Country Club, for example, is a house of his. It's a place called Edgemont. There are a handful of others. But the 4 principal, I think the shortest answer is 4 key buildings, 4 key sets of buildings.
Was Jefferson interested at all in landscape or landscape architecture, or was that not so much?
No, he was. There were lots of drawings, some of them in this collection, some of them reproduced in this book, of particularly at Monticello. But in some way, I shouldn't say particularly at Monticello, because both the University of Virginia and Poplar Forest is in miniature. You know, if you sort of want to get inside his head, Poplar Forest is a great way to do it, because it's a wonderful landscape. It's very symmetrical. He used landscape pieces as well as hardscape, as well as architectural bits. He was, of course, very interested in gardens and plants and so forth, so he had a rich knowledge. And it's a place that he did relatively late in his career, so I think it reflects his best thinking about all of this. I would recommend that to you, as well as the drawings of Monticello.
Any key architecture
questions the key architectural style of the Italians that he worked in mind. They were all working in a classical vein. Palladio was interesting, very much a student of ancient Rome. He measured buildings in ancient Rome and built buildings. His best buildings are actually those that depart the most from those buildings, but clearly that was the language that he taught himself. And I think Jefferson was a little bit more of an imitator and a little bit less of an innovator than somebody like Palladio. Sir?
Between the time that Jefferson died and the time that Monticello became in the public domain, was there much deterioration of what kept the building going?
The question is what happened to the building between his death in 1826 and 1923 when it came into the public domain and was taken possession of by the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation. It had a series of owners. The first one planted a bunch of mulberry trees on the property thinking that it would be a silkworm farm. That didn't work out so well. There were at least one or two owners before the Levy family acquired it, and 2 generations of the Levy family, New York Jewish mercantile family, owned it for,
I want to say 75 years, something like that. And in that period of time, they did relatively little to the structure of the building. They did pop some dormers, but they kept a solid roof on the place. They didn't fool around a heck of a lot. They put in a lot of hideous Renaissance Revival furniture. I mean, I like Renaissance Revival furniture, but it doesn't look right at Monticello. But basically, the building, when it was taken over by the foundation in 1923, was much less than a ruin, although less than in wonderful condition. But it hadn't been badly taken care of, shall we say. And the Levies are generally credited with having been reasonably good caretakers. I mean, we might, by the standards of today, we might not see it that way, but given that the building survives and is in wonderful condition, I guess we have to be appreciative and thankful. Jane, we're out of time.
Hello, how nice to see you. Okay, great.
Of course, we are actually opening an exhibit on the Declaration of Independence, very much as related. And Peter Drummy will be giving gallery talks at 10 and 2 on Monday. We'll explain all of that to you, so we hope you'll be able to come. And that exhibition will be up through the end of August right here at the Mass Historical. Peter Drummy has brought down some of the collections of different architectural drawings. So he'll be up here. Hugh will be up here.
Just bear with me for a second. I have to get some things out. But we just brought out a sample of the things that Hugh was speaking about to give you a sense of just a sampling of what these documents look like. And this is our copy given by Clara Coolidge of Thomas Jefferson, architect here, with her tipped-in letter, along with a modern reproduction of it. So if you're interested, just stay a minute until I get some things out, and then I'll show you up at the front that the show you this evening.
We should mention, instead of me singing to you, while Peter gets this up, that the name of Worthington Ford still lives on here at Mass Historical. The man who was so instrumental in helping Fisk Kimball, Conrad Wright, who is the director of research, is the Worthington Ford editor and director of research here at MHS. So that's a very apt, I think, way for his name and tradition to continue.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Leonard Tucker wrote a biography of Worthington Ford.
Okay. Oh, you had hiding in there.
Very good lecture. My name is Bill.
Hello, Bill. Nice to meet you.
Can I get you to sign your
absolutely. I'll give the letter.
The end. Bye.